one. I'd like to share with you tonight couple of like a thread of thoughts that was rooted in the not the last text, but the text before we studied in the study group, the one from written by Bernie Glassman, Instructions to the Cook. And in that text that we studied, there was a little a paragraph where he mentioned the Buddha's first word after his awakening. And he wrote that the Zen tradition, he says, he wrote, the Zen tradition I studied say simply that when the Buddha attained realization, he opened his eyes to see the morning star shining in the sky and exclaimed, how wonderful, everything is enlightened, all beings and all things are enlightened just as they are. You may have heard that quote many times. How wonderful, how wonderful. In fact, I looked it up. I have no idea where Bernie found that quote. It's kind of nowhere to be found, really. But it doesn't really matter, actually. I was reflecting about this. I mean, first of all, we need to, if we put our, we try to imagine the Buddha's awakening under the famous Bodhi tree. He's obviously by himself. And who knows what he actually said. And it was an oral tradition, and he taught, and people kind of imagine basically probably what he may have said if he said anything at all. I find it interesting that we love first words and last words as if they were encapsulating like in a nutshell the teaching of someone. What did he say in his last breath? And when they say something like, oh, I'm really tired, it seems like a really, or anything, it seems like we're trying to find some really deep wisdom into it. Probably same thing with the first words of the Buddha, as if they were encapsulating some kind of very deep wisdom. And but probably it says also a lot of about the person who write these words, what they imagine that he may have said. And so I would take it as this is Bernie's rendering of what he imagined, what the tradition actually said about all that. And there's a lot to say about it. How wonderful, how wonderful. And maybe we can, if we take it as a koan, like these quotes, how do I relate to these quotes, to that experience? So I started doing a little exercise, which is trying to find various how do you say rendering of in the text, what are the other versions What are the other versions that exist about Buddha's first words? And it's quite interesting because they very much differ in style, in content. And so I'd like to, share that with you and see if it helps us to understand anything about our own experience. And as we were sitting just before, I was, what came up also is how much we are all here because we met a tradition, we met a teacher, we met a path, and there is somehow this trust that, and the trust is even bigger when we actually start in this path, that there is something in there, in that experience that is relevant for us. And this is probably also why it's not impossible to imagine what the Buddha may have said, may have thought, as he had that experience of awakening that seems a little bit maybe foreign to us, but that we trust that we have that faith that maybe there's something that we can actually reach, tackle, understand, grasp, or, I mean, have a sense of it. I am totally convinced that we, all of us, have moments, at least moments of clarity, of insight, of what is called nirvana, everyday nirvana. Every, moments in our everyday life when things starts to stop, things starts to calm down, there's something that we are fully present, we let go of things. I mean, it's a very common experience. I mean, I always go back to the original term of nibbana, which is really the extinction of something, just like the heat just cool. It's a cooling down. That's what nibbana means. Nirvana means. So we all have that experience at least at some level, at some degree, at certain moments of that cooling down of things. At the same time, I also feel very, it can be sometimes very overwhelming, very puzzling, very unattainable, this idea that there's someone, that guy that we are on his footsteps, who had, from what the tradition tells us, this unbelievable experience that is really almost out of reach or unattainable or something. That can be very discouraging or misleading, or that can be, I guess, also very inspiring also. But if we think of everyday nirvana, maybe that seems more inspiring, maybe more encouraging to look at it that way. And so the first kind of one of the, maybe one of the oldest, I mean, if we look at the ancient texts, in the Pali Canon, what is called the Pali Canon, the Dhammapada, which is a very important, very well-known text, there is a sequence, a verse, where it is explained what they imagine, again, what the Buddha have said. And the quote goes as follows, the verse is goes as follows: Through many births, I wandered in samsara, seeking but not finding the builder of the house. Painful is birth, again and again. House builder, you are seen. You will not build the house again. All your rafters are broken. The ridgepole is shattered. The mind has attained the unconditioned. Achieved is the end of craving. Very unlikely that someone would actually say like that, coming out of a very deep meditation. But anyway, we have all kinds of very specific elements, almost like the whole teaching in a nutshell. Seeking but not finding the builder of the house. Painful is birth again and again. This whole idea of dukkha, of the kind of this unsatisfactoriness of existence, this painful dimension of existence. And house builder, you are seen. You will not build the house again. And at the end, achieved is the end of craving, as the outcome, this big insight of his awakening. Like the craving is this huge source of suffering, and if we achieve to end the craving, we also achieve the end of suffering. So does the tradition say. House builder, your scene, ask Lisa. House builder. You're seen. The question is, what is the house? Who is the house builder? What is the house builder, Lisa?
No, I wasn't sure I had understood properly. Seen.
Yeah, house builder. Yeah.
House builder, you're seen.
Right. You are seen. And so that refers to basically craving and ignorance. That's the house builder. It's the ignorance of, you know, of not seeing what the self is, or what the self is not, more precisely. So it's very, very elaborate and very, not very concise, and tackles on various issues that is very much developed in the teachings. I found another one in a sutra I had never heard about, which is the Lalitavistara Sutra, the play in full or extension play sutra discourse. And you have several elements, but also kind of an added element in there, which is quite interesting also. Profound, peaceful, stainless, lucid, and unconditioned. Such is the nectar-like truth I have realized. Profound, peaceful, stainless, lucid and unconditioned. So he's really kind of here is really described the is being described the experience itself. Were I to teach it, no one would understand. So I will silently remain in the forest. Um I guess all of us have, on occasions, tried to describe the content of our experience, what meditation is about. Yeah. That finding that stillness, the spaciousness, and it's what is it to have a non-discriminating mind, no picking and choosing. We use words to describe something that is indeed quite difficult to describe. It's actually very funny when we have it happens over and over again when on retreats we have discussions during Dharma talks, and when it starts to be a little bit intellectual, when we start to put words on things, and suddenly it's like we're really, the more we speak, the more it seems that we go further away from the experience. And I guess I always like to think of the Zen tradition as a way to bypass that difficulty by trying to use the language in a different way, to bypass the dualism, and by making sentences that seems quite illogical or nonsensical. But I think it's worthwhile. It is worth questioning. How would we describe our own, experience? What kind of words would we use to describe that when we are in really, when we feel we manage to have that experience of a collected, gathered mind, when it's calm, when it's, what would we say? Actually, after saying so, I will silently remain in the forest and bear in mind also that what happened is afterwards, the what made him go out of the forest is his desire to help others to realize that. And so he adds, well, he adds in the text, it is added that he says that which is free from words cannot be understood through words. Likewise, the nature of phenomena is like space, totally free of the movements of mind and intellect. And here we are always kind of talking about it. And yet we have discussions with Lisa and all the other teachers, like, what on earth? Are we talking about? And yet, can we venture in saying something about it? Then we arrive at Dogen, and so Dogen is very funny because you probably have heard that many times. This story about when the morning star and I and the sentient beings of Earth simultaneously attain enlightenment. You probably heard that sentence many times. When the morning star appeared, I and the sentient beings of Earth simultaneously attain enlightenment. So I tried to locate that, and it's because it's attributed to Dogen, so kind of did the research, and it said, oh yeah, it's somewhere in Shobo Genzo. So I looked in the Shobo Genzo and the specific fascicule where it's supposed to be, and it's nowhere to be found. So I did more research. It's like, well, no, it's not really there, but it's like more in the other one. And actually, he never said that. He never wrote that. Again, it's like people later on, centuries later, that attributed that to Dogen, or like trying to encapsulate his teachings. But that, again, that also adds another element to it, which I find very interesting, which is the dimension of the other. I and all sentient beings all together simultaneously. So that adds another dimension that is nowhere to be found in older versions of it. Which again, that is quite a significant addition, a significant added understanding of what awakening is, what the experience is. But you see the move from the Dhammapada, where it's not about the others. It's about how he's gonna talk about it, but that dimension that I and all the others simultaneously we awaken. That's something that Dogen, not in these words, but obviously apparently Dogen just taught. And the morning star, because it all happens with a morning star, apparently it looks like it was a significant symbol both in India and in China, for as a symbol of transformation, a symbol of renewal. A symbol that a shift occurs. And I guess we have, if we go back to our own experiences, we have tens, dozens, hundreds of small shifts when we sit. And then we lose it, and then we go back, and then we deepen it. Where there's a shift that occurs. So, yeah, all that to say that, there are various, we projected, the tradition projected, many sentences in the mouth of the Buddha, that sheds lights, different lights, to what that experience might be. What is it that he had, but more significantly, probably those who wrote these words had also. It's very moving. I find the way Bernie expresses it. You know, we could just stopping. I could just stop at the how wonderful, how wonderful. Just it brings me back to the feeling of calm and serenity and completeness that I may have at the end of a retreat after days of sitting when things get calm and just nothing is really, nothing disturbs, nothing is disturbing. It's just, it seems perfect. Everything seems perfect. When we finished the retreat in Oisy two weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and some of us went for a visit of the castle of Fontainebleau outside Paris, and we were talking about the various experiences of people had just after retreats. Roshi. I remember Roshi saying how she was on the train. She mentioned that story many times and how she wanted to hug everybody. And, or yeah, things are very. So obviously, we may have an experience of, oh, everything is perfect the way it is. And then that sensation, that impression fades away at some point very quickly as we get back into our lives. And but then we can also connect to that experience again. Actually, I was quite surprised not to find. I'm sure if I had dig deeper, I may have found more and more. But I couldn't find that many, actually. Mention of that particular sequence in the Buddha's awakening. I was quite actually surprised. Maybe I didn't look enough. I'm not sure, but was already quite inspiring. Yeah, I can open the discussion and you have any comments on all that? Yeah, sure.
Yes, thank you. Good evening, everyone. I was noticing when you were talking about when the Buddha attains enlightenment or something, you know, this going into the forest and then and only then, this movement of getting out of the forest and going towards people. So I noticed that So it was it was surprising for me that his experience of enlightenment doesn't it doesn't necessarily follow from that this movement towards you talked about helping. We could, I guess we could talk about serving. Ultimately, the way I'm trying to see that is Sangha, basically. This including, so to speak. But it's interesting that this guy, the Buddha, you know, this is not like it doesn't necessarily follow or it doesn't immediately follow. Although he says, you know, or supposedly, you know, something, all beings are, all beings throughout space and time are enlightened, however, whatever they are or something. So, but it's interesting, I never noticed this, you know, it doesn't, like it doesn't necessarily follow. It's like a
Follow that he's not gonna go and meet the others, is you mean?
It's just maybe I'm seeing it wrong. I don't know. It's just I don't. This, you know, this how it's not immediately. You know, this is my thing, so to speak. I'm simplifying. You know, this is not communicable. This is not translatable. This is not shareable or something. So but it's interesting.
And actually, what you say makes me think of. If you put the two together, it's like the two quotations that are totally different. But like, if everyone, me and all the others at the same time are enlightened, why do I actually need to go anywhere and do anything with them? You know, you could ask that question also. What I did find very interesting, I remember clearly when I read that, when we had the center a couple of years ago in Paris and we were starting, and I was, it was kind of, the beginning when I started teaching, and I encountered this text where just after he had his awakening, and he did decide that after some thinking that he would just move out of his forest and try to meet people where they are and teach, you know. And the first encounters, the first two at least, are just a complete disaster. And for me, that was very inspiring at the time. I mean, it still is, actually. It was complete disaster. His first encountering is like with a person, with a monk, or with a mendicant or something, I forgot. And he's trying to say something about his amazing experience. And basically, the guy says, "Well, good for you. Ciao." And then there's a second person that he meets, and then it just doesn't work at all. Until the moment where he goes to this to meet his former friends, and it's still a battle. The guys that his former friends are not taking it for granted. And they're like, yeah, I mean, first of all, you moved away from all the ascetic practices. I mean, you're just a fake one, you know. And they were very, just they didn't believe. And he really, it's really funny when he's trying to explain once and twice. It's just his former friends are like, yeah, no, we're not buying it. And he's really has to, defend his case, basically, that it was genuine and what kind of move things around is not actually what he says. If you look at the text, it's like they witness that something has changed in him. Not from what he said, but just like the way he is. I was thinking the it's always very illuminating when maybe our friends start to comment about how we have evolved since we started practicing. Have we changed at all? Are we the same, or are we just exactly the same? Are we behaving, in the same way? Would they say, yeah, no, he hasn't changed, or I mentioned that I don't know where, when, maybe my last talk, but I was so moved at Bart's transmission when his wife spoke. It was so moving when she said, when he started, I was not happy about it. I was against it. I didn't like it. And I saw him change. And he was a very silent and discreet man. He's still very discreet, but he opened up. He opened up. He has opened up over the years. And so testifying, yeah. And going back to the Sangha thing, this is where I feel also the Sangha in taking that term into a large sense, our friends, our families, anybody is they put our practice a test. They are the ones that really can testify whether or not we have something has changed, and we need to pay attention to. I feel we need to pay attention. We can really benefit from what they are saying. It's not just how we feel internally. Yeah, and it's quite moving also, this movement of, as you say, Juan, so he doesn't want it, and just he spends some time, and then just he decides, well, yeah, that cannot, even though it cannot be explained, we have to try. It reminds me of when I was studying philosophy, I was very much into a philosopher called Wittgenstein. He was my hero, and there was a he's at some point he's talking about language, and so going into the difficulty of how do we talk about what we're talking about, he says, imagine that we all hold a box, a box for matches, in which we have put a cockroach in there. And I cannot see what you have in your box, and you cannot see what I have in my box. And yet, with language, we can all kind of comment how our cockroach looked like. Because we have language. We'll never be able to see exactly the content of that experience, but still, it doesn't forbid us to actually talk about it and understand, kind of, by analogies, metaphors, and this is why we have all these stories, and the only thing that we actually share are just stories, hoping that maybe that's inspiring for one another. I always loved that cockroach story of Wittgenstein. Thought it was very, quite telling.
I think I'd be scared of asking my mother if I've changed. She probably would say no.
Bye, Krisha. Yeah, well, yeah. I can't remember what I think that question came up at my the question was asked to my friends at my transmission, and I think one of my friends said, not really. A waste.
Well, but to know that, I mean, because they've changed too. I mean, if you talk to somebody and say, am I different than I was 20 years ago? They're 20 years farther along too. So it's
True.
kind of hard to, I mean, I was when you were saying that asking people that, I don't know what people would say to me. They'd probably lie and say, yes, you're not so angry.
You have to ask the people at the Gare du Nord.
I mean, I guess it's already very important that we just feel more at peace, you know. But I also very often wonder. So we got older, what would have happened if I hadn't practiced also, you know? Maybe it's just the age, you know. With the age you get calmer, you get so and so, but not necessarily. And who cares actually? It's just like the question is, do we feel that it's, yeah, do we feel, at least like if we feel that for ourselves it's beneficial, that's already something.
C.K. Lewis says it in one of his sketches, even stupid old people know something just by the fact of being old, even if they're kind of stupid. I mean, you're bound to pick something up.
Yeah. Another translation of the text from the Lalitavistara Sutra is, the ambrosial Dharma obtained is profound, immaculate, luminous, and unconditioned. The ambrosial Dharma.
The what?
Ambrosial, qui a le goût de l'ambroisie, yeah.
Oh.
Nect, which was translated in the other translation, I guess, nectar-like truth. Yeah. Remember the what we're singing the during the karaoke. Yeah. The water with which I wash these bowls tastes like ambrosia. During the retreat, we had a whole discussion actually, because at the end of the line it says, I offer to the various spirits to satisfy them, and a newcomer said, so what are these spirits really? What kind of spirits are they? So we had a whole discussion with the spirits. What are these spirits? Very interesting discussion.
But sometimes Sitting does not bring you peace and quiet, and it's a lot of agitation, and it's also and
Yeah.
questioning and doubts and great doubts.
Yeah. Yeah, but
That's also it.
that phase is usually not the phase of the awakening. It's prior to the awakening, you know. And again, I mean, if you think of also the story of the Buddha, what he went through before reaching this profound, immaculate, luminous, unconditioned space. You know, it was Mara, it was the war, it was fighting, it was like, you know, a lot of agitation. Yeah. And the calm and the peacefulness came from the fact that he said, "I am this." Putting his hand on the wall, on the ground to just take the earth as it's his witness. That's how he defeats Mara.
Evening,
Yeah.
everyone. So it was in this moment, after having this big conversation with Mara, that he put the because I was thinking somehow I heard his first word there, the heart is my witness, but it's not after he was illuminated. It was when he
That was during his fight with Mara, or
okay.
his confrontation with Mara. Yeah.
Okay.
But it's true. I often say that to in you know introductions to meditation. It's like this idea that it might be a very misleading to see, to say, oh yeah, meditation, you're going to find bliss in meditation or just calm. It's not necessarily calm, and it's not, it's I keep saying, you know, if you arrive with a lot of anger, you're going to meet your anger. If you arrive with a lot of agitation, you're going to meet your agitation. It's like meeting people where they are, but it's also meeting yourself where you are. And sometimes because of that, it's very unpleasant. Yeah. I think we can all relate to moments in when we were struggling in our sitting, facing, you know, boredom, anger, agitation, questions like, what on earth am I doing? Not pleasant. Not pleasant. And actually, in the Theravada tradition, there are meditations on the Vedanas, the feelings of you know of whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and become tune in to these feelings, to these tonalities, as Christina Feldman call it.
Times, it had happened to me that the day that I am more tired and really all kinds of agitated minds, and when I see it's like duality on in a shift. It's when it is so easy to calm down. Sometimes it happens to me. I don't know why. It's when I'm really with all stuff inside me and it is so easy. It's kind of duality, you know, the shift, it's really quick sometimes. I noticed it, this, and it's really strange. Why? Because it's not gradually, or it's like this. I noticed my dog when he is very agitated. I put him like do some kind of little things, and immediately he sleeps. So maybe something in our brain is prepared to just reach the other duality. I don't know. It's about duality, this I am sure, but it's really powerful. Our nature and our mind is wise sometimes. I find it. I think it is to be wise. Because I'm not choosing anything. It happens, it just happens.
Yeah, it happens. Yeah. That was the whole, discussion also about how do we make it happen? Is it just happening by itself without any effort on our part, or is it because also we do the practice and that creates the favorable soil for that to happen? But it does happen. Dropping body and mind. All right. If no one has anything to add, any last word of Zen? We can stop here. Well, thank you so much for sharing and listening, and we'll just continue the practice.